You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to an emergency doctor about how drug overdoses have ramped up since the beginning of the pandemic. But first, in September, Nathaniel Frank was bitten by a black mamba, perhaps the most feared snake in all of Africa. But the Wisconsin native wasn't traveling abroad. He was in Oshkosh, where his lab is one of a handful in the world that produces the venom used to make antivenoms. Megan Hart has the story.
Frank has done thousands of venom extractions over the course of his career. The black mamba bite is the only time he's ever needed antivenom.
It's the most painful, terrifying experience because every person's body reacts to venom differently.
Of course, Frank had the antidote handy. He was treated and released the same evening. Then he was right back to work. Frank has been keeping reptiles and amphibians since childhood.
Well, I was the six-year-old kid flipping over rocks and all that stuff and finding salamanders and following turtles.
It's a tight-knit group who work with these potentially deadly animals. And for Frank, the hobby turned into a career after a university in Australia asked him to send venom from a rare species he kept. Demand grew from there. Today, M-Toxins is located on a commercial block near downtown Oshkosh. It's open to the public with snakes, birds, and other animals on display. But the real draw takes place behind a large plate glass window. That's where Frank extracts the deadly venom used to make the antidote for bites. Before entering the extraction area, he runs through the same checklist as pilots.
If you're feeling ill, you're not allowed in here. If you have a medication change and you're not set up, you're not allowed in the room. If you're stressed, if you've had alcohol within the last X amount of time, are fatigued or emotional.
Frank has the snakes bite into sterilized vessels so he can collect their venom. The chalices can hold enough to take out dozens of people. The liquid venom is then dehydrated, turning it into a fine powder. That's how it's shipped to customers.
This is one of the main drugs we provide venom for. And this is the African polyvalent antivenom. And then all it is in here is saline to reconstitute it. And what this is actually freeze-dried horse plasma.
To make antivenom, manufacturers gently dose host animals with enough venom to generate an immune response. It isn't often needed in Wisconsin, where there's been just one or two deadly bites since 1900. But the threat is real in other parts of the world. More than 100,000 people die from snake bite every year, and many more lose limbs. The World Health Organization calls it a neglected tropical disease.
It's a huge problem that sort of lurks right under the surface.
Jordan Benjamin is a wildlife paramedic and founder of the Asclepias Snakebite Foundation. He says snakebite is a complicated problem.
It varies, you know, across Africa, but we do know that I would say roughly 95% of bites happen in rural areas far from hospitals, and less than 5% of those patients will ever receive antivenom.
Benjamin says many victims seek treatment from traditional healers or struggle to reach clinics. As a result, it's not profitable for hospitals to stock antivenom or for companies to make it. In fact, there's a global shortage. The foundation operates a clinic in Guinea that offers public health education, training for local healthcare workers, and free treatment. The antivenom it administers is made with M-toxins venom. And venom from M-toxins serves research purposes, too. Dr. Leslie Boyer is a toxinologist at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Tucson, where she treats patients for snake bite and scorpion stings. She says predators, including snakes, have evolved toxins that can exploit our weaknesses.
And it turns out that the very same substances that make my patients so sick that they could die or lose a limb, if you tease them out and study them one at a time, could be the next miracle drug.
She says venomous animals have helped unlock heart medications, painkillers, and diabetes drugs. Frank says he hopes that's what visitors to M-Toxins take away. The animals there aren't creepy.
And they don't chase you.
In fact, they serve valuable purposes. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. This week, the U.S. officially counted 500,000 people who died related to COVID-19. And yet, that's not our only public health crisis. The country saw a record number of overdose deaths last year, more than 81,000. 500 of those people were in Milwaukee County. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the pandemic may have played a role. Drug deaths started spiking last spring after the coronavirus forced shutdowns. It left people stressed, isolated, and without necessary support systems, all known triggers for addiction and relapse. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 to join this conversation about substance use disorder. How has the pandemic affected you or the people you love? Have you seen the isolation we're experiencing bring people on the brink of relapse, or have you seen people find ways to be healthy? Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Dr. Chris Eberline, an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. Dr. Eberline, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you.
As we've spoken in the last year, I mean, a couple of times since May, you have said that, you know, La Crosse County saw a 63% increase in overdose deaths last May. How have things changed since then?
Yeah, unfortunately, it didn't get any better. We doubled the amount of overdose deaths that we had the prior year. And it's even more significant than just the numbers, other than obviously the impact on the families and so forth. But we had seen a really promising trend locally of reduction each year up until last year. So not only did it completely reverse our trend, but we saw this doubling of the death rate in our county.
Well, as you're looking at the trend, then what do you wonder about what it looks like even as we emerge from the social distancing, the lockdowns, the staying farther apart? What do you think that does, and how far back has this set us?
Yeah, a lot remains to be seen. Obviously, we're still not out of the pandemic, and a lot of the things that kind of I feel triggered this, but I think it's going to be a long road to get back to where we were. Like I said, we're not through with the pandemic. You know, mental health is not something that when it takes a hit like that, it's easily reversed. And so you're going to have this group of patients that are continuing to suffer, and those that have turned to substance abuse, it's going to take them a while to either get into treatment, to get the help they need. And we haven't turned the corner on anything, on any of those issues yet, to start reversing this.
Let's be clear. We know that substance abuse is a physical challenge, but you're saying it is also a mental health issue.
For sure. This is I like to look at substance abuse as a chronic disease with very strong overtones of mental health. You know, a lot of people are looking at that to self-medicate, for some of their underlying mental health problems. So it's really rare you see someone with true isolated opiate use disorder. They almost all have some underlying depression, anxiety, other things going on in their life as well.
And for whatever reason, as people are using these drugs, they often don't, as we understand, intend to take too much of the drug. What happens that's what they end up doing?
Yeah, it's really rare that we get someone back from a overdose that it was an intentional suicide. It does happen, but it is very rare. The vast majority of the time is they are utilizing one of these drugs, you know, fentanyl in particular. We've seen a very strong increase in that the last couple of years. You know, the fentanyl they're getting on the street each time is a different concentration. And when you're dealing with something that just, you know, we measure it out in micrograms, it just takes such a small amount of difference to take you from the high they were looking for to an overdose death. And they just don't know what they're getting each time. And so it's really rolling the dice every time they use.
Have you seen different kinds of overdose in the pandemic, or is this, a continuation of fentanyl being the problem?
You know, fentanyl is our primary cause of death with this, but we are definitely seeing other overdoses and people coming in the hospital with, alcoholism has upticked as well. You're seeing obviously methamphetamine abuse has continued. So we are seeing more mixed toxicology, but the underlying cause of death tends to be the analog opiates like the fentanyl.
We're talking with Dr. Chris Eberline, who's an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse, looking at how the pandemic has increased the risk of drug overdoses. I'm Keely Boltina. Join our conversation by calling 800-642-1234. 1, 2, 3, 4. What do you see that is working or isn't working when it comes to helping people with substance abuse right now? Do you know someone who's been affected by an overdose? We're going to talk about naloxone. Have you had an experience with someone who has needed to have that overdose reversed? And what do you wish you knew then that you know now? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us your story at ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Emergency boxes holding an anti-overdose drug are now publicly available in 11 communities in Wisconsin, from West Bend to Mequon, Portage to Beaver Dam. The rescue medication helps save people who've overdosed on opioids. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about the rise in overdose deaths we've seen since the pandemic took hold with Dr. Chris Eberlein. He's with us and is an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How have you seen drug addiction affecting the people that you see? Maybe you work in the medical field. How are you handling an increase in people who are seeking treatment for addiction? What do you see that's working? 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Eberlein, let's talk a little bit about these Wisconsin groups installing boxes with naloxone in some places. It's used to revive people who've overdosed. How easy or difficult is it to administer?
The administration of that drug is extremely easy. Usually it comes in a like a prepackaged, it's not a syringe, it's a cartridge, and it goes in the nose, and it aerosolizes up into the nose. It's absorbed almost immediately, and it starts reversing that overdose.
What do you think about making this medicine more publicly available?
It's a very important component of limiting the deaths in the epidemic of opiate overdoses that we've been seeing. We've been really pushing on getting Narcan throughout the community and including boxes like you speak of to people that are at risk. And we call them overdose safety kits. And in it, we have Narcan. We have a list of resources in the area that you can go to get help. And also a pocket mask so someone can give some rescue breaths and have that barrier protection when they do that, because ultimately it's the respiratory arrest that kills these patients. And so if you can give rescue breaths, even if you don't have Narcan, if you can do those rescue breaths and no CPR, those are things that can bridge that gap as well, even if Narcan's not available.
And we're talking about similar things. When you say Narcan, it's a nasal spray version of naloxone. It's a brand name, just to make sure that people understand that we're on
that
the same
correct.
Page here.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
but, you know, people who might come in contact with people who are at risk or worried about them should have naloxone. And yet it's like $40-ish if you need to purchase it at a pharmacy. Is cost prohibitive still?
The cost is definitely prohibitive, and there are programs available. There is the Narcan Direct program, so some of the counties have applied for that, and they're able to give it out for free through certain county programs. But you're absolutely right. The cost is prohibitive at $40, and that's for a single dose. These boxes of the simplest to use is the Narcan nasal spray, because it's prepackaged and it's very very concentrated, so it's easy to administer. And we've had the best luck with reversal with that concentration. But like you mentioned, it's $40 a dose, and it comes as a pack of two. So you're talking at minimum $80 to have that available if you're paying cash for it.
Let's take a step back. What are the reasons someone might need to use Narcan? What are the symptoms of an overdose?
So anyone that's used and that's overdosed on an opiate, they will slow down their breathing. Their pupils get very, very small, and then they become less and less responsive. And so when someone starts to overdose, that intervention, the sooner you can intervene with Narcan, the better to start reversing that. And in particular, you know, the thing that, like I mentioned, that kills these patients is the respiratory depression and respiratory arrest, because the opiate affects the sensor in your brain that tells you to breathe. And so your breathing gets slower and shallower and slower and shallower, and the patient doesn't realize it because of the opioid. And so ultimately they stop breathing, and that's what will eventually develop into cardiac arrest.
How much time do you have to administer naloxone when you suspect someone has overdosed?
It depends on where they're at in the overdose and how much they've taken, but the sooner the better. This is an extremely time-sensitive intervention.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and that's why if it's not available, those few rescue breaths are so important. To bridge even until you get the package open, a couple rescue breaths can make a big difference on keeping that patient alive.
And naloxone can help keep a patient alive, but there's a long road after, I guess, kind of neutralizing an overdose from opioids.
There is. And Narcan, naloxone, has a very short half-life. And oftentimes a lot of the drugs that drugs they use and they overdose on actually last longer than the naloxone. So it's not uncommon they need another dose half hour, 45 minutes after the initial, even they wake up. So that's another thing. We've seen patients that they've gotten naloxone, they've woke up, bystander friend has given it to them, and they haven't called 911 or been seen because they thought that was it. And then they re-overdose off of what's in their system after the naloxone wears off. So I really encourage patients and anyone listening that if you've overdosed and you need naloxone, you call 911 and be evaluated because, there is definitely deaths occurring because of that delay, that secondary delay that we're seeing.
We're talking with emergency physician Chris Eberline about opioid overdoses and the challenges of healthcare for addiction when our COVID-19 safety measures keep us apart. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Dr. Eberline, what are state health officials, state leaders doing to help address this spike in overdoses that you're seeing every day?
So, locally we're, I think it goes down to the local effects. One, these programs like Narcan Direct, where Narcan is given to county organizations and agencies that apply for this grant for free, is fantastic. And I really hope that doesn't go away because it would be cost prohibitive for a lot of these organizations that are giving it out to purchase it. So that's the first thing. And then continued support for addiction services, mental health services. As you mentioned, the pandemic has really put a lot of stress on a lot of people. And, we've seen this increase in need for mental health services due to that. And obviously all forms of addiction, whether it be alcohol, opiates, methamphetamines, all of these are really affecting our communities. And we really need more support on continuing battling this because it's definitely did not go away with the pandemic for sure. And in fact, it's gotten much, much worse. It was when the pandemic first started, I remember talking to one of our coordinators, Al Bliss, about the pandemic's effect on overdoses and where it was going to go. And we were trying to predict the future. And I was wrong. I thought, well, maybe it won't be as bad. Maybe we'll be able to stay where we are at least. But unfortunately, I was way off on that prediction. And the resources and stuff we had in our community, a lot of patients weren't reaching out because of the fear and they weren't keeping their appointments. And it just really kind of got people in a bad spot. And the social isolation has been hard on a lot of people. Some of our most vulnerable patients and our most vulnerable population has really suffered from all of this. And unfortunately, we're seeing it in overdose deaths.
People who are in the middle of full-blown addiction, the reality is that you'll have to treat them. They're going to do drugs. With that in mind, what recommendations do you make for people in that circumstance when you know they're not going to get help and they're going to take opioids?
Yeah, I think the most important thing that we can do is have these resources available and make it easier for patients to navigate our systems. because that is one thing that we've noticed locally, and I think that's pretty much universal, that the healthcare systems can be hard to navigate, and especially for opiate use disorder as well. So supporting patients getting into like navigators or someone that can help them navigate that system, because it is really hard for them to sometimes find the right provider, the right treatment agency, and have this stuff available, because you never know when that patient's actually going to be ready to make a change. But what you don't want to have happen is they're ready to make the change, but we're not ready for them. And that's what we don't want to happen. So when they are ready, we want to be ready. So that way it can line up and we get them into the treatment they need, the counseling they need. And you know, a lot of patients really do very well. They can get, and this is not a disease that no one recovers from. And sometimes people look at that and they have that stigma of this disease in mind and that it's their fault and we can't help them. And that is so wrong. We can help these patients. There are patients throughout our community that were in a bad, really bad place with their addiction, but they've recovered and they're productive members of society. They're working side by side us, but you wouldn't even know it. So don't look at these patients as someone who's it's hopeless.
So there is hope. Dr. Eberlein, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. He talked with us about drug addiction and a rise in overdoses during the COVID-19 pandemic. We've also set up a link to details on that story about the public naloxone boxes. You can find it at WPR.org/centraltime so you can read more about the locations and the intentions there. Coming up, if you're a parent or student thinking about the confusing world of paying for college, our next guest has some advice for you on picking a school and figuring out how to afford it. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. Thank you to everyone who donated during our winter member drive. Support from people like Joan and Madison makes the daily conversation and smart entertainment you value on Wisconsin Public Radio. So if you missed the drive, there's still time to join in. You can make your donation and ask for the WPR t-shirt or the water bottle at WPR.org. Your gift makes such a difference so we can keep Wisconsin informed and connected. Thank you. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. The price of college, like homes, has been ramping up significantly, and that makes the decisions around paying for it and how to pay for it that much more complicated. And what we know from colleges themselves about how and why different people pay different amounts for tuition, it's pretty much clear as mud. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 as we take on this conversation. Are you a student or a parent or a grandparent shopping around for colleges? What questions do you have about how much higher education costs and what you should be thinking about? Call 800-642-1234 or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Ron Lieber. He wants to help people better understand why college costs what it does and how to make the price more affordable. He writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, and his new book is called The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest financial decision your family will ever make. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You use the word price in even the title of your book. It's important to note the distinction between the words cost and price when we deal with college. Why?
Well, the price is what some people refer to when they're talking about the list price before any discounts that come from need-based financial aid or merit aid that has more to do with, say, your grades and your SAT scores. When people talk about costs, at least in higher education world, they're talking about the costs that are required to educate a student. the budget, right? But these words often get tossed around interchangeably by parents who should not be faulted for not knowing any better. But when you're listening to people talk about this, it's important to define for yourself and to clarify exactly what they are actually speaking about.
So is it fair to say that the cost of college has gone up?
So the cost of educating undergraduates has indeed gone up. And the biggest reason that it has gone up is because the people who do the work are expensive. Why are they expensive? Because they train for a large number of years to become qualified to be tenured or tenure track professors. And, you know, basic economics suggests that people would not train for that long if there wasn't some sort of above average compensation coming their way. The other reason that the cost has come up is that in general, there is a larger number of administrators, not professors, but administrators in these institutions for every 1,000 undergraduates. Why is that? Because there are more regulations than there used to be about fair and equal treatment of students, and staying in compliance requires well-trained people to keep an eye on things. And then there are also the demands that families themselves are making for bigger and better computer networks and bigger and better mental health counseling centers and bigger and better career planning offices. And all of those offices require staffing, require more administrators, and not just 23-year-olds, but actually people who are, you know, well-trained and experienced. And so that is the biggest reason why the cost of educating undergraduates has risen.
So there are real changes that have happened maybe since the adults in these circumstances went to college themselves or knew people who went to college. We can't necessarily make assumptions based on the way things used to be.
I think that's right. And one of the things that's changed dramatically is that, you know, when you go to the state house or the state houses all over America, one of the easiest things to cut in a recession is the subsidy that the state government itself supplies to the public university system. So we saw it in 2009, 2010, 2011 with that brutal recession. Subsidies from the state were cut. And when that happens, you face a difficult decision as a university administrator. You can either raise prices to students or you can cut back programs and fire a bunch of people so that you don't have to raise prices. Many institutions did both of them. We are now in the middle of another recession, albeit a very different one, the origin of it was different, right? But the result is going to be the same, which is that states are going to get less money in tax revenue. And when that happens, the easiest thing for them to do is to sort of stick it to the state university system and let those administrators figure it out. And so we are likely to see tuition hikes and perhaps cutbacks yet again.
Okay, so the costs of college have gone up, and yet you write that the amount people are actually paying the price has not gone up quite at the same level, even though the list price, as you call it, might be higher. How does that work?
Yeah, so this gets confusing, right?
All of this stuff is confusing when dealing with college costs and what you pay and where you get your loans and all of it. It's a real, like, really complicated thing that we expect people who are, you know, 17, 18, 19 to take on.
I sense a growing sense of exasperation in your voice, Keely, and I am so glad to hear it, right? Because all of this is way too complicated, and it's not your fault as a parent. It's not my fault as a parent. It's not the fault of the well-meaning administrators who inherited the system. It's maybe the fault of some of the state legislators that want to stick it to the university budgets, but we'll try not to get political here. The fact of the matter is this, right? The list prices at many of these institutions have gone to the moon. And indeed, if you are running the show at the University of Wisconsin at Madison and your state subsidy gets cut in a recession, it is very tempting to raise the price for out-of-state students to the moon in the hopes that a whole bunch of affluent families from the San Fernando Valley in California and from Long Island and from the North Shore of Chicago are going to be willing to pay that higher price because their kids really love Madtown, right? So that is a tempting thing to do. Now, at the state level, right, in-state students, maybe they are continuing to qualify for, or more of them are qualifying for, you know, academic discounts based on their own circumstances. Maybe their financial circumstances and their decreased assets in a recession has caused them to qualify for more need-based aid of various sorts. So much depends on who you are and where you're coming from. And if you're a private institution, right, if you're Lawrence University, if you're Beloit College, if you are Knox College in Illinois, if you're Grinnell in Iowa, you're in a market, you're competing with other schools, and you have to sort of hand out discounts accordingly to bridge the difference between people's ability to pay for your list price and their willingness to do so. And that plays out in secret, in background, on a year-to-year and sometimes day-to-day basis. And it's not easy to understand.
Ron Lieber's new book is called The Price You Pay for College. We're talking about it now, and there's room for you in this conversation. You can call 800-642-1234. How has the pandemic changed how you are looking at college experiences or what you might want to get out of it, what you want for your kids? Have you or someone you know made a change in the middle of college because of the pandemic or because of the money? We'd love to hear your experience. You can call 800-642-1234 or you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Ron, saving, how do we gauge it effectively when we don't even know what the price of college is going to be when kids or grandkids reach the right age?
It's an almost impossible problem. And so I encourage people just to kind of break it in chunks and try to guess, if you have a small child, what it is that you might be able to provide and might be willing to provide, you know, come 15 years from now. And there's a financial planner up in Eau Claire named Kevin McKinley, who presented a very compelling and relatively simple way of thinking about this to me years ago, which I still refer to. And he just suggests dividing it up into chunks, right? So if your goal is to get your kid to Madison, 15 years from now, and you figure that, the all-in cost is, let's call it $100,000 in today's dollars, if you don't get any need-based aid or any merit aid, right? Think about dividing it into thirds. Save a third in the first 18 years of their lives. Spend a third out of your current income when they're in college, and then borrow a third divided between the parent or parents and the student equally, right? Now, you can mess around with those fractions any way you want. But once you start sort of breaking it down that way, you realize, oh, I can probably come up with that amount of money if I actually commit to it when my kid is born by saving roughly $75 a month, right? You put it in a 529 college savings plan, maybe 60% of it is in stocks. You get some growth there over 18 years, and you can save that third. And it starts to feel doable. All the better if there's a grandparent around who wants to throw $20 a month at the challenge as well. Even $20 a month can make a big difference over time.
We've got Dave in Ironwood, Michigan, who's ready to join the conversation about paying for college. Hey, Dave.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call. What I saw in Michigan was the money from the state was steady, but I saw I used to work at a junior college, and I questioned the fact that only certain faculty were getting the raises and other faculty, like me, were taking freezes. There was sort of a collusionary aspect of management and the teachers' union only rewarding certain professors with increases. And then every year the tuition would go up, and I saw that as fraudulent.
Dave, thank you for sharing that. I'm sorry I jumped in right there, but I wanted to get Ron's response because I think Dave speaks to a point more specifically that a lot of people have that says, we're paying all this money into college. What are you using the money on?
Yeah. So, you know, in the same way that every school exists in a marketplace, every person offering their labor in that institution is itself part of, you know, a marketplace for labor there. And some people and some groups have more leverage than others. And sometimes it does not seem fair. But the fact of the matter is that there is a lot of unequal and I would argue unfair treatment of faculty and teaching labor out there in the marketplace. There are all sorts of people who are brought in on what's known as an adjunct basis, right? They're paid maybe $2,000 or $3,000 per course, and they have to string together 8 or 10 or 16 courses over the course of a year in order to just scrape together a living. A lot of these adjunct faculty qualify for food stamps, right? And as a consumer of higher education, even if you do not have a moral and ethical issue with contingent labor in this way, still, you know, are you getting your money's worth, right? Is that teacher going to be around in a year to write your kid a recommendation for grad school or to help them get a job? Will they be around in 2 years to continue a mentorship relationship that might have been started in the classroom? If an institution is using a lot of adjunct labor, you may not be getting what you think you're buying when it comes to a, you know, continuity of relationship with that faculty member or with faculty overall.
Dave, thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. If you've got an experience like Dave or you've got a question when we're talking about the cost of college, now's the time, 800-642-1234. What are you struggling with in making decisions about choosing a college or continuing to go to a college? Or what are you thinking about whether you have kids or you just recognize that this is something that we're up against as communities? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're talking with Ron Lieber, who is the author of Your Money column for the New York Times. He's got a new book out about paying for college. We continue this conversation ahead on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about the price you pay for college. That's the title of the new book by our guest, New York Times financial columnist Ron Lieber. We are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That number again is 800-642-1234. Go ahead and give us a call now if you've got a question. Ron, you were just talking about the fact that some colleges don't manage their money well, and you might not be getting what you pay for. The other part of this is that you might not be learning as much as you think, or your kid might not learn as much as you had hoped going to college. You have a whole chapter about that in your book.
One of the things that was astounding for me when I started diving into the data is that, you know, on an institution-wide basis, very few of these colleges are, you know, testing people on the way in and testing them on the way out to find out, you know, just how much, you know, sort of smarter or more capable they are, you know, at the end. And what I'm talking about are, you know, sort of more overarching kind of critical thinking and analysis skills, not the more micro things that you can test for, you know, on a biology exam or in an English paper. And when a couple of really sharp researchers who are in the academy themselves spent years tracking this down, what they discovered is that at many institutions, many people are not making a lick of progress. And I just found that amazing, right? But then again, if you take a step back, you know, what these academic, quote unquote, academic institutions don't really like to acknowledge is that there are a lot of people who go to college just for the kinship, right? The friendship, the connections, the mentorship, and the credential, right? And not so much for the learning and the intellectual roller coaster at all, right? And I make no judgments about people who choose college or pursue college in that way. But the schools both don't like to acknowledge that it goes on and then don't do very much to prove that people are actually smarter on the other end. And I found that surprising. Hmm.
We've got Kathy in Madison who is ready to join our conversation now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. So I got a child that's going to graduate in high school in June and very bright. And, you know, I don't even know where to start as far as trying to get her apply for colleges and where to find these resources, you know, as far as maybe getting some financial help. I did save $100 a month when she was born, so I got that. I guess some starter money, but it's only about $25K, and I know that's not going to cover 4 years. So I guess, where do you start? Where do you start?
Kathy, I don't think you're alone in that. Ron, some quick advice for Kathy.
Well, sure. Not every 18-year-old is ready to go to college. Not every 18-year-old should go to college right away. And not every 18-year-old should go to college at all. And, you know, if you have a teenager on your hands who just has no idea and doesn't seem motivated to apply, it might be because there's something else they should be doing in the world, at least for a little while. And there's no shame in that. And there's no harm in that. In fact, it might be good for them because a lot of 18-year-olds have no business in college and we're wasting money the money that we spend sending them there, forcing them there, wedging or nudging them in when they may not be ready.
Well, and especially then if they have to accrue any sort of loans and then they don't wind up with a degree that they can use to make more money and pay them back. I mean, that's a big problem with our student loan crisis right now.
Exactly. It is the worst of all worlds to go to college and to borrow money to be there and then not to finish because you're not ready or you don't know what you want, because then you end up with the debt that you have to repay, but you don't end up with the increased earnings that come from actually having the degree.
Ron Lieber, if our caller's child says, no, I absolutely want to go to college, should they start regionally? Should they start by trying to figure out what how much each college costs? Should they call the actual college? I mean, where do you begin? Is it an online search or a phone call or something else?
Well, it begins with a guidance counselor at your high school. Some of these counselors do heroic work, even though they often have hundreds of students who report into them. So, you know, do your level best to get that person's attention. Talk to them about the things that you're interested in studying, the kind of student that you've been so far. And hopefully that person has some suggestions and some instructions for you. One of the next things you can do financially, right, is think about the most likely destination, right? So, you know, you're thinking about UW-Milwaukee. So every one of these schools has what's called a net price calculator. And so you go to Google and you type in University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee net price calculator, and out pops a calculator. Every school has to have one. And you put in a bunch of your financial data and it predicts for you about what sort of need-based financial aid you might qualify for you. So that begins to give you a sense of, okay, well, I've managed to put away $100 for 18 years a month. So that's what I have saved. What might this institution ask me to pay for each of 4 years, right? And then you can begin to think about, all right, well, how much am I comfortable borrowing, if anything? And then my kid can take out, you know, roughly $30,000 in federal student loans. How much might they earn? How much can I contribute out of earnings? And then you can start to do some math and see what's affordable. And if going to a four-year school for all 4 years isn't affordable, then you can start with community college and do it that way.
We've got Meg in Presque Isle ready to talk with us. Hey, Meg.
Hi, thank you. I have a question. Online learning, community college versus an accredited university. It's all very confusing. What is the value and what is the importance of choosing? Because online learning is really affordable, but I'm going into psychotherapy. I want to know that my degree is going to get me a good job.
Meg, thank you so much for the question. And Ron, we've got about a minute left. How do you balance the online degrees with accredited universities in person?
Sure. So if the object of the game is to get into a clinical psychology PhD program, those PhD programs are extremely choosy, and chances are you're going to be better situated to apply for grad school if you go into the, you know, kind of the most selective or prestigious university you can get into, or, you know, go to your state university and just shoot the lights out and get the attention of, you know, the best psychology professor that you can to write you a recommendation for later. Now, if the object of the game is, to graduate with the lowest amount of debt, get into the lowest price, you know, Master of Social Work program and become a therapist that way, then, you know, you may want to start a community college or maybe even with a 4-year online degree and then take your shot at the MSW master's degree programs that way, because those programs can be kind of expensive. So, you know, it kind of depends on your goal.
Sure. Meg, thanks so much for the question. And Ron, thank you for joining us today for the good conversation and also some practical tips in here.
It's my pleasure.
That's Ron Lieber. You can find his regular Your Money column in the New York Times. And we talked with him today about his new book, The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest financial decision your family will ever make. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow, the pandemic canceled music festivals and concerts, but vaccines now offer artists and fans hope of reconnecting. Hear from a musician about her experiences during the coronavirus crisis and about her new music. That's tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock on the Ideas Network. Coming up next now, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then, the older we get, the more our friendships tend to fade to the background. We talk about prioritizing friendship later in life with the author of the new book, We Need to Hang Out. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is Central Time.